You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a WPR reporter tells us about the latest efforts to stop the spread of chronic wasting disease in the state's deer herd and how deer farms fit into that story. First, the search for answers continues in the death of a 13-year-old Milwaukee girl who was shot while inside her home last week. Authorities say Sandra Parks was in her bedroom Monday evening when bullets came through her window. Two men have been charged in her death. The motives remain unclear. 2 years earlier, Sandra wrote about Milwaukee's gun violence in an award-winning essay commemorating the life of Martin Luther King Jr. She read an excerpt of it on Wisconsin Public Radio's The Kathleen Dunn Show in January of 2017.
We Shall Overcome has been a lost in lies of who we are, who we have become. We need to rewrite our story so that faith and hope for a better tomorrow is not only within us, but we believe it and we put it into action. Our first truth is that we must start caring about each other. We need to be empathetic and try to walk in other people's shoes. We shall overcome when we begin to understand and accept others. We shall overcome when we eliminate the negative and nasty comments people make about each other. We shall overcome when we love each other and people around us.
The voice of Sandra Parks on the Ideas Network in 2017. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Sandra is at least the fifth Milwaukee child fatally shot inside a home in the last 4 years by gunfire that broke out outside. She was also the city's 91st homicide victim this year. Reggie Moore is the director of the City of Milwaukee's Office of Violence Prevention. Reggie, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, question, of course, on people's minds is why does something like this happen? I understand there's not a motive, but as a city official who's working to stop gun violence, what is your reaction to something like this happening?
I mean, whenever we lose a child or anyone in our city as a result of violence, you know, it is something that's disturbing. It's something that, you know, we're committed to preventing, that the mayor is committed to preventing, but we have to look at it holistically. I think, you know, people, you know, obviously want a quick, you know, answer to violence, but understanding that there's a lot of complex factors that contribute to violence. And so, you know, while working on an individual level, we also have to work on a systemic level when we look at, you know, high rates of concentrated poverty, over-incarceration, all of these factors that lead to, you know, individuals carrying firearms, using firearms, whether intentionally or recklessly, and obviously endangering the lives of children and adults in our community.
Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett spoke to reporters about gun violence in the city. Here's a part of what he had to say.
It's just insanity. You're never going to solve a fight with a gun. You're never going to settle a score with a gun. But you see it over and over and over again in this country. And that's what's so mind-boggling, is it's in this country that we see it over and over again. And we don't have leadership at the national level. We haven't had leadership at the state level that say we're going to address this issue.
As you said, there's a lot going on, Reggie. What would you want to see, before we turn to what you're doing there in Milwaukee now, what would you want to see from the state or national leadership that might help you there in Milwaukee?
I mean, there definitely has to be policy changes. I mean, fundamentally, literally, you had children with the March for Our Lives who literally, you know, were crying and marching and rallying in D.C. and have been traveling throughout the country since the Parkland shooting, calling for policies and universal background checks. The federal, you know, government, federal leaders have to listen to the voices of young people who've been impacted by this issue, and not just in school shootings and mass shootings, but the everyday carnage that we see around the country. And at a state level, there has to be an increase in resources for prevention. And so that is something that, you know, on a local level, when we talk about, you know, permitting cities to be able to secure the necessary revenue and resources to be able to fund things like the Blueprint for Peace and efforts and the strategies that are called for in it is critical.
Talking to Reggie Moore, director of the City of Milwaukee's Office of Violence Prevention, talking about gun violence in the city, in part because of the death of Sandra Parks, a 13-year-old shot in her own bedroom, bullets through a window. Reggie, let's talk about that blueprint for peace now. As I understand, this came about after 2016, gun violence, gun deaths had peaked in the city. They've come down a little bit since then. But what kind of initiatives did you start off then?
Right. And just a point of clarity, it was 2015 that this fight happened. And it wasn't just in Milwaukee. It was several similar sized cities around the country. And it's been a spike that, you know, researchers have been trying to explain. There's no definitive, you know, answer as to why that spike happened, but, you know, several different theories. But one of the things that the city did was ask itself a sobering question, is what are we going to do about it? And it's hard to answer that question without a plan. And so in 2016, we engaged as many residents in the city of Milwaukee from a range of different backgrounds and experiences, but particularly centering folks that have been directly impacted by violence to really say, what are the strategies that we should be engaging in to prevent violence and to also help individuals and communities heal once violence has occurred? And so that's really what the blueprint calls out. And so its DNA is basically 6 goals and 30 strategies that do just that. And so it includes everything from looking at economic development, youth and family development, also looking at restorative justice. And so everything in terms of thinking about all of the things that we should be investing in to increase the protective factors that could protect a community or a family from violence are the things that investment is needed. And then we look at risk factors as well that the community prioritize, looking at segregation, looking at high rates of unemployment, looking at the eviction crisis and housing. And those are the risk factors that need to be addressed so that people don't engage in violent crime for matters of either survival or the street economy and things like that we know significantly contribute to gun violence. So it's a blueprint that not just deals with gun violence, but it deals with the intersection of different types of violence. So it talks about child abuse and sexual assault. It talks about domestic violence. When we understand that in the state of Wisconsin, 40% of gun homicides are domestic violence related. So we can't just look at violence in isolation or one type of violence. We have to look at the intersection of all forms of violence, including policy, because disinvestment in certain communities or neighborhoods or disinvestment in youth development programs are all forms of violence inflicted on communities that create conditions that we see create, you know, what we're seeing in Milwaukee and cities like it around the country.
I've seen you quoted talking about the importance of mentors for youth, especially in places with higher rates of violence. What kinds of things can mentors do?
Right. And one of the things that, because the blueprint is very comprehensive, so sometimes people, you know, have a lot of questions once they read through it. And one of the things that I tell people is, number one, of the 30 strategies in the blueprint, some of them are being implemented. Many of them actually are being implemented. The question that we have as Office of Violence Prevention, taking it from a public health approach, is saying, are we prioritizing the populations and the places where these strategies are being executed? So, and there are also strategies in the blueprint that are not being executed. And one of them is mentoring of children who have incarcerated parents. So when you look at the high rate of incarceration, particularly of African Americans in Wisconsin, and you look at in terms of the supports for the young people in those families, you literally have an adult who's been, you know, forcibly displaced from that family and leaves a void. And so one of the things that, you know, although we know that children are being served by youth programs, but their explicit needs and the trauma of losing a parent, whether it be to homicide or incarceration, has a significant impact. And so really wanting to prioritize and work with partners like the new effort called Mentor Milwaukee and Big Brothers Big Sisters and NPS and saying, is there an opportunity here to actually create specific programming that supports, you know, this population of young people so that we can break the cycle both of incarceration but also of violence and trauma?
I know for people looking in at Milwaukee from the outside, they might not see a lot of the what's going on at the community level, local neighborhoods organizing or local neighborhood organizations. I've talked to some people doing that. Can you talk about what kind of things are happening at that super local level?
Right. There's a lot happening. And literally the blueprint, we call it the plan for the people, by the people. And, you know, thousands of residents were involved in this process, including young people. And so even, you know, highlighting this summer when we had the spike in homicides in August, you know, we called the community together and residents from, again, all walks of life, young people, old people, you know, and everyone in between to say, look, you know, we understand that law enforcement has a job to do. And obviously they're working to try to find, you know, the folks and hold them accountable. But what can we do as residents to really also, you know, help and support families who've experienced or been touched by the homicides that have happened? And what can we do to try to shift the culture and the narrative in the community. And so over 130 people came together through every week over the month of August. And in between those meetings, because the meetings were really used to plan the actions. And so it was a lot of outreach that occurred, helping families in terms of organizing vigils and providing counseling supports to the children and adults in those families. Also partnering with groups like Guns Down Milltown, which is a grassroots effort that was developed by a local artist, where we helped fund billboards and bus shelter ads to really promote the message of peace in the city. We currently have a ad campaign called We Live Here to really highlight what does it mean to live in Milwaukee. Unfortunately, people have ideas and visions of what it means to fail or die here, and we want to flip that narrative and that reality to say, no, we need to have a vision of what it means to live and thrive here. And that's what the blueprint calls us to do. And, you know, the community has definitely stepped up, and I think has always stepped up. I think, you know, what we have to ask ourselves now is we have a public policy document developed by the community to say this is what we should be doing to reduce violence. And now the question is on leadership to say, are we going to invest the policies and resources to honor what the community has told us needs to be done?
It's a good place to leave it. Reggie, thanks for joining us today.
No, thank you.
Reggie Moore is director of the City of Milwaukee's Office of Violence Prevention. We talked with him about the deadly shooting of 13-year-old Sandra Parks last week and anti-violence efforts in the city. Coming up, we'll look at a new report from WPR and the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism about chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin's deer herds and this, what the state's been doing about it. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the way Congress operates has changed a lot in the last 30 years, and according to a new report, that's given us a legislative branch that's less productive and less powerful than it used to be. We'll dig into some of the reasons for gridlock in Washington. First, Wisconsin's annual gun deer season wrapped up yesterday, and for a lot of hunters who took part, that meant getting their deer tested for chronic wasting disease, or CWD. But state data shows the number of deer with CWD in Wisconsin is continuing to rise, raising questions about how effective the state's response has been at stopping the spread. Rich Kramer is a WPR News reporter based in Eau Claire. He's the author of a new report looking into CWD, co-produced with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. You can find that online at WPR.org. Rich, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be here, Rob.
Well, before we dig into your new reporting on this, remind us what CWD is and the effect it has on deer.
So CWD is shorthand for a disease that is known as a transmissible spongiform encephalopathy. It's a mouthful. So chronic wasting disease is a degenerative brain disorder that affects cervids, which are basically deer, elk, moose, etc. And the disease is caused by what are known as prions. They are misfolded proteins that, when ingested by a deer, it causes a decline in the animal. And generally, clinical signs will show up in a deer about 2 years in. So deer that have been spotted with this disease in the later stages, they lose their fear of humans, they drool, they basically don't act like deer do, and eventually they waste away, they lose weight, and they die. The disease is always fatal for deer.
And over the last few decades, Rich, the story has changed from will CWD come to Wisconsin, when will CWD come to Wisconsin, and then how much can we contain its spread? Can you talk about how it is spread around the state?
Well, that is still, I mean, so the general understanding is that CWD is transmitted between deer through bodily fluids. When an animal defecates or urinates, the prions are shed from that sick deer. It's also thought that the CWD is transferred from nose-to-nose contact or animals eating from the same piles of food. So that's one way. Also, hunters can transport the disease. In the old days, you used to shoot your deer in one place, throw it on the car or the truck, and head to a different location. And when the deer are butchered at home, generally, in the past, sometimes hunters would throw the carcass in the woods. So it's thought that human movement causes it. Also, the disease spreads naturally through contact between animals.
A big part of your new reporting on this, Rich, has to do with these deer farms, these places that raise deer often to allow people to come on and for a fee hunt those deer. How do they fit into the CWD puzzle?
Well, you know, when CWD was first discovered back when we had our first positive test in 2002, since then, some people have pointed to the deer farming industry as maybe one of the causes or a vector for this disease to spread, because deer farms, and it's 380 or so of these operations around the state, and a lot of people don't even realize they exist. So, as you mentioned, deer farms, there are breeding farms that raise deer for sale straight to slaughter for venison. There's also deer farms that do sell their deer to these game farms, these hunting ranches, where hunters can go in and get a trophy buck. So a lot of hunters have kind of pointed their finger to the deer farming industry as maybe how it got here or how it's being spread. That is uncertain right now, as especially for a cause of why it came here. But there's more and more concern because there's just an increasing number of positives that are coming out of these farms.
And how does Wisconsin compare to other states when it comes to regulating these deer farms and CWD?
Well, in 2013, there was a big change. So the USDA oversees nationally deer farming, and they also look into CWD outbreaks at these operations. And in the past, in Wisconsin, before 2013, any deer farm that tested positive was depopulated. That's a fancy term for saying that regulators come in and kill all the animals, they disinfect the property, and then they reimburse the owners for the livestock that they lost. Because, you know, even though we're talking about deer, with regards to deer farming, they're considered livestock. Something changed. There was a quiet change at the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection in 2013, which allowed some farms to continue operating. They don't all continue, but right now there are 9 positive facilities that are in operation, and 7 of those have seen an additional positives.
And the governor had recently suggested emergency rules regulating the deer farms. What were they, and what happened to them?
So there was 3, basically. So the governor called on the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, also known as DADCAP, and the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, to create 3 emergency rules. The one would have banned movement of live deer from deer farms within counties that are listed as CWD affected. It would have also banned hunters from moving deer carcasses, for the most part, outside of CWD affected counties. Think of areas like Iowa County, which has had a lot of CWD cases. It's considered one of the hot spots. And then finally, the governor also called on the agencies to require additional fencing at all deer farms. Right now, deer farms at a minimum have to have a single 8-foot high fence. This would have required either a second fence of that kind or else electrical wires going around. The idea is to try to keep nose-to-nose contact from happening with deer between deer inside and outside of the fence. But that the only rule that made it through was the additional fencing requirement. The DADCAP board of citizen board that oversees the agency took no action at first. They're working on rules now. The DNR also got a legislative committee that oversees agency rules, got rid of the hunter ban on carcasses, and then though the fencing rule does exist, it was amended to give deer farmers until September of next year to comply when the rule itself gets deleted in February.
So it sounds like not much is changing. Now we've got the governor, the legislature, the DNR, DATCAP all involved, plus some federal regulation. You write that some people are a little frustrated that the efforts against CWD haven't been coordinated well enough.
Yeah, some hunters are quite fed up with the DNR the DNR and DATCAP for not being more aggressive on CWD in general. One group, it's known as a citizen advisory group that advises the DNR. It's called the Wisconsin Conservation Congresses. The delegates have long called for more action on to slow the spread of CWD in the wild herd, and also they've called for things like fencing, double fencing at these deer farms. So yeah, there's frustration. But then on the other side, you've got a number of hunters that aren't that concerned about the disease. It's really interesting that on one side, some people say it's a direct threat, could pose a huge problem for the state's deer hunting tradition as a whole. Others don't think it's as bad as people say it is.
And for deer that test positive for CWD, but nobody's supposed to eat them, right?
Well, the Federal Centers for Disease Control say that it's uncertain. There have been some studies that have shown it could be possible, but it's uncertain that humans can contract CWD from eating infected venison. But if the deer tests positive, the CDC recommends against it.
And one thing in your reporting I hadn't seen before, Rich, some deer farmers in particular are hopeful that there might be deer with who are maybe more genetically resistant to CWD.
Yeah. One farm in particular, one game farmer, his name is Greg Fleece. He's over in near Rosholt, and he's working with a researcher out of a Midwestern university in Arizona, and they are studying. They found, and researchers in general have found, that certain genetic markers in deer show some resistance to the disease. So this individual's goal is to try to breed a herd that is resistant, and he thinks it could be a solution to the issue. But other research shows that resistance takes a long time to build up, certainly more than 5 years, which is what the deer farm owner is hoping for. But also that while some genetic markers show that deer are resistant, it's still a fatal disease to any deer that contracts it.
Rich, very briefly as we wrap up, do you expect to see new efforts from the state given that the problem keeps growing?
Well, deer hunting, or the state's deer herd, is a really political animal, pardon the pun. But so the state has been resistant to make any large changes that would make it harder for hunters to do what they do. Also, there's been a certain amount of resistance from the deer farming industry to any new regulations that they say would cost them a lot of money and put them out of business. So it'll be interesting to see what happens when there's a new governor in town. The legislature is still, controlled by Republicans. A lot of those don't want to make any drastic changes. So we'll see. That's
Rich,
the short answer.
Rich, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's WPR reporter Rich Kramer, based in Eau Claire, talking about his reporting on chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin's deer herds. Find more at WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, John Munson's guest makes the case that Wisconsin agriculture is suffering from overproduction and smaller scale farmers are being hit the hardest. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, if it seems to you like Congress isn't working quite like it used to, you're not wrong. A lot has changed over the last 30 years about how things operate in the Capitol and what lawmakers are able to accomplish. A new report from ProPublica and The Washington Post crunched the numbers on everything from amendment votes to committee hearings and found that many of those key measures of the legislature trending downward. It's been due in large part to a series of rule changes enacted by both Republicans and Democrats. Derek Willis is a news applications developer at ProPublica, focusing on politics and elections. He's co-author of the piece, How Congress Stopped Working. Derek, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, Derek, I think people feel a lot of frustration out there about Congress being gridlocked and dominated by partisanship, but also maybe you feeling like, well, what are you going to do? That's Congress. It's always been that way. You tried to crunch the numbers and find out if that's really true, right?
That's right. And I can certainly sympathize with folks who do feel frustrated with Congress. And certainly Congress is set up to make big changes kind of hard to do legislatively. But what we were looking at, my co-author Paul Kane of The Washington Post and I, was basically we were looking at these kind of indicators of what rank-and-file members of Congress can do to actually impact a legislative outcome. And so, for example, one of those is voting, proposing amendments and getting votes on their amendments. And that's a really key part of the process, and it's one that's really has been kind of really atrophying because leadership doesn't want to hold amendment votes, and for lots of reasons, but it's easier for them, it's more efficient for them, if you will, to just sort of restrict the number of amendments that get voted on and then also to kind of move the process along.
Yeah, can you talk about that decline in amendments? Let's focus in on that a bit. What have you seen over the last few decades?
Sure. So typically we looked at both the House and the Senate, and it's the same overall picture in both chambers. But let's take a look at the Senate to start with. In the Senate, you know, maybe 15 to 20 years ago, 3 out of every 4 roll call votes, you know, where senators have to actually vote yes or no, 3 out of 4 of those votes came on amendments. And so that's a large part of what the Senate actually did when it acted as a legislative body. This Congress, that's down to 1 in 5 votes is on an amendment. Partly that's because in this Congress there have been a lot more votes on judicial nominations and other nominations, but mostly judicial nominations. But even if you took out all the nomination votes, the number of amendment votes is still way down and perhaps at a historic low. It's tough to tell since we don't have every last vote that's ever occurred in the Senate since its inception. But we do know for the modern Congress, votes on amendments are at a historic low. And in the House, debate on legislation is a little bit different in the sense that it's governed by a rule that members vote on. They say, okay, here are the rules under which we're going to debate this bill. And in the House, there can be different kinds of rules. And so you can have an open rule, which means that any member can offer an amendment as long as it's a relevant amendment. And at the other end of the spectrum are closed rules in which no amendments can be offered. And in between is sort of this idea of a structured rule where you can offer some amendments, but only the ones that the party leadership allows you to offer or wants to be offered. And we haven't had an open rule on the House floor in more than 4 years, which, again, appears to be, certainly for the modern Congress, it appears to be a record. So this is sort of how the sort of standard parts of legislative debate are being choked off.
Let's talk about what that means for balance of power. You were talking about that everyday elected official, the local member of Congress, say, it sounds like then they're not one equal out of 435. The balance is much more tipped toward the leadership.
Right. And to a certain extent, rank and file members have actually willingly surrendered this, you know, their authority on this. They have said to leadership, hey, we're mostly okay with you kind of controlling not just the agenda, which leadership has almost always dominated, but also literally like how we debate things. And so what that means is that, yeah, rank and file members have a lot less sort of individual authority and agency to make things happen. And the other side of that is that party leadership has a lot more control over not just what bills come to the floor, but under what circumstances they come to the floor, and whether or not, you know, individual members can be heard with particular concerns that maybe, you know, maybe they're not on the committee that produced the bill, but maybe they have a particular interest or a particular insight that they want to try and put forward. That's a lot harder to do now in both the House and the Senate.
We're talking to Derek Willis from ProPublica, co-author of the piece How Congress Stopped Working. Derek, do we know why this change happened, why this amendment process has atrophied so significantly?
We know a good deal about why it's happened. We don't have every last answer to it, but in large part, it has stemmed from essentially the polarization, the nationalization of Congress. And so as Congress has come to reflect the broader political trends in the nation, as you know, Republicans and Democrats, the divide between them has widened. Party leaders have responded by seeking and obtaining control over the legislative debate, more and more control. And so this really started to kind of go downhill right after the 2008 election. Up until about 2008, you still had some semblance of open debate in both the House and the Senate on a fairly regular basis. But after the 2008 election, after Barack Obama becomes president, what you see is in both chambers, you see the both parties sort of turning to their bases and trying to, you know, be able to control that legislative debate in part because they are concerned about the opposition party trying to make them look bad with maybe votes on bills or amendments that they don't want to have or that would be politically difficult. And so what we have here is, in large part, is we have leadership in both parties trying to protect their members from taking difficult votes, politically difficult votes. And what that means is that in most cases, that kind of makes it difficult to reach consensus on pretty controversial topics.
And so we see issues like, say, immigration reform, which we talk about at least almost weekly here on the show. This is an issue that Congress, multiple Congresses, have been unable to tackle. And that's another thing you look at is the rise of gridlock and Congress not being able to get much done, apart from that the personnel stuff you mentioned, approving presidential appointees.
Right. Immigration is a great example because here's an example of a topic where a broad majority of the American public would like to see some solution, some action on this issue. And I think most legislators would like to see some action on this issue. Obviously, they differ on what that action would be. But even with that sort of momentum or kind of foundation to build on, Congress has been unable to produce a piece of legislation that it can get majority support for. And in part, that's because the parties have disagreements within the party, among Republicans and among Democrats, about what should be done. But the other part of that, and a significant part of that, is that the debate over legislation, with leadership exercising a lot of control, what they want to avoid is they want to avoid surprise outcomes. And if you were to have an open debate on immigration in the House and in the Senate, it's not exactly clear what the outcome would be. And so there's some degree of thought that, well, maybe the better part of valor then is to not have that debate if we can't guarantee what the outcome is going to be.
Now, this seems like a big flaw because, right, this is a legislative body. It's supposed to be a deliberative body. That's kind of the point of having something like Congress, right? Is this a flaw as compared to how Congress is supposed to work?
I mean, I think a reasonable person could arrive at that very conclusion because, really, it is there to sort of not adjudicate, really, but to legislate, to talk about issues and to propose solutions and try to, reach agreement across party lines. And when you are prevented from the opportunity of reaching those agreements, then, the amount of legislating that you get to do is restricted. And as a result, it's not just Congress the outcome falls on here, is that, as a result, you have the executive branch saying, under both Democratic and Republican presidents, looking at what Congress is doing and not doing and saying, well, okay, well, maybe we can step in here and have some action if Congress isn't going to do anything.
We'll pick up on that point coming up with Derek Willis from ProPublica, talking about a recent piece he co-authored, How Congress Stopped Working. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your opinion of Congress? If you disapprove of what they're doing, do you put their blame on certain leaders, one party, the system as a whole? Do you think that changes are needed? And if you're a supporter of a party, do you support compromise but only from the other party? I mean, do you want your party, if you're, say, a Democrat or Republican, do you want them to compromise or do you want them to obstruct the other side at every turn whenever possible? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue with a look at the balance of power between Congress and the president coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Derek Willis, news applications developer at ProPublica, about his report he co-authored on how Congress stopped working. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you frustrated with gridlock in Congress, with partisanship? Are there changes you think could improve the way that Congress functions? Are you worried about how rules have changed? Are you worried that The legislature has too little power now compared to the executive branch, the president. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Derek, let's pick up on the point you left us with there. If Congress is doing less stuff, if they're not able to get stuff done, the powers of the president, the executive branch, might be expanding.
Right. I mean, it essentially creates, in some circumstances, a vacuum. And so what will happen there, the executive branch, the folks there will look at that and say, hey, they're not acting on something. Maybe we can, or maybe we should. Or if there's public demand that they should act and Congress isn't acting, then the executive branch is also, the president's also responsive to the American public. And so they often will, try to, fill that gap. I think the DACA, the immigration action, executive action, both by President Obama and then the immigration actions by President Trump are examples of this kind of thing.
Let's bring on a caller now. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. I always amused at discussions about the differences between the parties. I recall some time ago that Gore Vidal wrote an essay for the Nation magazine on their State of the Union on their 125th anniversary, in which he remarked that it's people occasionally try to start a third party in this country, and they all make the fatal mistake of thinking that there was two parties to begin with. The parties don't differ on the important issues like spending money we don't have and going into wars that we have no business in. They serve corporate interests and divide and conquer the population over superfluous issues.
Jim, thanks for the call. I think a lot of people would say there are significant differences on immigration, taxes, abortion, a lot of other things, Derek. And the people in Congress that you talk to definitely see differences between themselves.
There are differences, but I think what we see and what our reporting on this piece has shown is that despite those differences, one thing that leadership of both parties and both chambers can agree on is that they would like to remain in power. In other words, they'd like to preserve the majority if they have it, or gain the majority. And so preserving the majority when you have it often, has come to mean in the last 10 years particularly, it's come to mean avoiding votes that could cost your members their seats. I think there was a pretty dramatic lesson in the passage of the Affordable Care Act by Democratic majorities that Republicans, sort of used against them in the subsequent election. And I think Democrats kind of took a lesson from that. And I think you've seen majorities be sort of more careful, their leadership be more careful about trying to avoid that kind of circumstance again going forward. That means that a lot of times they won't act.
Jim, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Al in Eau Claire. Al, hi.
Hi. My opinion is that the system is working that we have in place. It's not pretty, but it works. And I do have one question. Has historically balance of power shifted back and forth between legislative and executive over the past 200 years?
Gotcha, Al. Your line is not great, but Derek, he was saying, hey, we've seen the balance of power between the presidency and Congress. It's gone up and down over the years. No big deal if the pendulum is swinging one way right now.
Jim's absolutely right that the balance of power does swing back and forth. And we do see Congresses in history that are sort of more active, more aggressive about sort of asserting what they're, trying to do, their prerogatives. I think what is different this time is that this is happening, I think, under presidential administrations of both parties and with congressional leaders of both parties. That, I think the difference here is that it's become kind of the normal for Congress, almost regardless of who is in charge. And so, like, that I think would be my response in terms of the difference between a legislature that sometimes does seem to get, steamrolled a little bit by the executive versus, when it comes back around and tries to, push the executive branch around a bit.
Thanks for the call, Al. We're talking to Derek Willis from ProPublica, co-author of a report called How Congress Stopped Working. Back to your calls now. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. I don't think that always compromising or always obstructing is the right way to go. I think you need to be discerning. Certainly, if one party wants to do something completely unethical or just plain crazy, I mean, you don't want to compromise there. I mean, what would meeting someone in the middle on slavery be like? But at the other point, if you need to compromise, you got to understand where your opponent is coming from, and also look at both of you look at science and evidence-based policies.
John, thanks for the call. Meeting in the middle on slavery was one of the biggest previous crises of Congress over American history, Derek. But let's get to that point he had. We should have people in Congress who can compromise or obstruct as they see fit. You talked to current and former politicians. What kind of things were they saying, Derek, about fixes they might like to see?
So some of them would, you know, suggested that Congress simply needed to be together more often. So like working more often, in session more often. A lot of them talked about, especially those who are no longer in Congress, talked about a time when congressmen and women were, you know, like they socialized together in Washington or had their families live in Washington. And I'm not certain that that's something that we can sort of just magically roll back to for a bunch of different reasons. But certainly it is less likely now that a member of Congress from different parties would sort of run into each other organically on Capitol Hill because their schedules are very, very compressed, and they've got, they're traveling back and forth to their home states and districts, and, you know, their voters want to see them, and so but that was one thing that people mentioned, essentially, was, hey, we should just be here more often and have, you know, be in each other's presence more often, and that would help smooth the way for us to actually talk to each other and get things done.
John, thanks a lot for that call. Derek, I wonder if that is possible with the 24-hour news cycle, broad cable news networks, the internet. Everything a politician does is being scrutinized, and maybe there's a sense that they got to play to their crowd and play to the base. The handshake with the opponent today is the primary ad against them tomorrow. Is that part of the story here?
Yeah, it definitely is, in the sense that people do have to think about things that maybe they didn't have to give a lot of thought of to previously, whether that's a speech on the floor or whether that's even just, as you said, like sort of standing in with somebody, talking with them, smiling, laughing at a joke, something like that. You see that like on the House floor when people are, voting, when the House is voting, the cameras don't really pan the floor that often, but if you're in the House chamber, you can see members of Congress talking to each other and asking each other's questions and doing the things that you would kind of expect. But that's one of the few places that they can sort of do that without a lot of scrutiny. And so I think this scrutiny is part of the issue. I think also there are members of Congress who want to have that kind of audience, who want to have a national audience, and want to sort of play to that crowd. And I think, that also can hamper the ability of other folks to say, hey, that might be somebody I can work with.
Very briefly, Derek, as we wrap up, any signs of a change back in the other direction anytime soon?
So they're not totally encouraging, no, but I would say that, like, it has been interesting over the past couple of weeks to see, we'll have a different majority in the House come January. And it's been interesting to see some of the new members of that Democratic majority try to at least push against what their leaders or presumed leaders would like to do. And I think that, there is always hope that members will want to or will be maybe even motivated to, act on their own rather than to cede so much authority to leadership. Because being a member of the House and the Senate, like, they are powerful positions, even if a lot of times it doesn't seem like they're, that they are. There's some agency there that people can use. And so when you see people, members of Congress, actually, doing the things that they can do, using the rules and the platforms that they have, I think there's always some hope for that could continue.
Thanks to our guest, Derek Willis. He works at ProPublica. He's co-author of the piece we've been talking about, How Congress Stopped Working. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a major federal report on the impacts of climate change came out on Black Friday. A climate researcher tells us what's in the report and what kind of action is needed to prevent a worst-case situation. That, and look at some of the other top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow at 8:30, this mysterious illness, acute flaccid myelitis, has been spreading and getting a lot of attention in the media, has a lot of people wondering what it is, why it's out there. A doctor tells us what the disease is, what we know about it, and what's next in efforts to stop it. That's tomorrow at 8:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to an immigration reporter about peaceful protests that turned chaotic this weekend at the U.S.-Mexico border and get the latest in efforts from the Trump administration to change the rules surrounding amnesty. Asylum, I should say, not amnesty. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.